Hi, I'm Amit.
I'm Dan, and this is Mobility Now.
Today on Mobility Now, we discuss threats to OEMs and why Tesla is not an automotive company from the CEO of U+, Jan Birnbach. Hope you enjoy this episode.
Historical buildings in the area. A lot of people don't know this, but San Francisco was a big ship building area for over thousands of ships during the war.
World War II or which one?
World War II, yep.
Oh, really? I have to read up on that because that could be interesting.
In fact, the Navy still owns some of the area in the Dog Patch area and in Hunters Point, Bayview. And those are old shipyards where they used to do, they built mostly non-combat ships. A lot of the combat ships were built on the East Coast, Norfolk, that area. Transport ships, oil tankers, a lot of the support ships were built here. And that's why we had the ironworks and the shipworks.
I mean, it has that industrial vibe, but also like everything's new, everything's shiny, everything's clean. You know, I have an electric skateboard so I can get to downtown in 10 minutes, you know, on it. So it's, you know, I liked that in 2017 and I was sort of, you know, colorblind for all the construction. My girlfriend really didn't like it then.
Yeah.
And now she loves it because it's changed.
That's great. Yeah, we'll have to go out for a drink sometime there.
Yeah. Let's do it.
Great. So, I think we already started. This is great. I'm just going to start as we already started. We already started talking. But unfortunately, we lost your last podcast, and this is our fault. So it was so good that Zoom didn't accept it. So we have to redo it. But there's been a lot of exciting developments in the last couple months, and I think that's a good time to talk about them. So why don't we just get started and talk about what we think is number one right now was the Cruise automation picking up the CEO of GM.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Mary Barra. We saw that video. And what's funny about it is Dan and I were talking. We're thinking, okay, that's great. You get picked up. But as a consumer, what do you expect after you get picked up from that vehicle? Are you expecting some Netflix? Are you expecting that you would have your temperature controlled, your seats warmed, your seats cooled? Is it subscription? Are you willing to pay 50 cents more to have all this? Like, what do you pay and how do you build those business models? And I was talking to Dan. Dan knows very well about it. You want to talk a little bit about that, Dan?
Yeah, you know, you bring up a good point. A lot of those videos that Cruise and the other guys too, Zooks and Waymo, all release these videos of passengers really enjoying the ride and being excited about the self-driving aspect. But that's not going to last. When this becomes a commercial implementation, the marvel of the technology is going to wear off. So then what happens? These videos were cool to see. Mary Barra, CEO of GM, watching her ride after she fired the previous CEO of Cruise and then now released a video of her riding in his car. I thought that was great.
To be fair, he was the kind of like the business CEO. The real guy, Kyle Voigt, is still there, the CTO who started the company.
That's true. That's true. Yeah, you're right. I thought it was interesting the area that they chose to deploy in. You know, this service is now available and you can sign up. It's not available to everybody yet, but you can sign up to be selected to be one of the testers. But the area that they're testing is out in the Sunset and Richmond District in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. For those of you who don't know where that is, there's sort of the downtown and tourist Fisherman's Wharf area that a lot of people think about when they think San Francisco. But on the other side, on the western side of San Francisco, there's more of a suburban area, and there's a beach at the very end. It's called Land's End. And this area is a lot of straight streets, perpendicular, they're wide, not a whole lot of pedestrians and obstacles like what we see in the downtown area, which has all kinds of stuff from electric skateboards like Jan rides, bicycles and everything. There's also lots of hills. The Cruise has been testing in that urban area. I see the Cruise cars all over here in the downtown area. So I thought it was an interesting choice for them to start their deployment out in Richmond. Yeah, well, what do you guys think? Why do you think?
Before we get to that, I want to allow Jan to introduce himself. Let everyone know how he got here. I think he's one of the most accomplished guests that we've had, and he's kind of in that region that's going to be ubiquitous for the automotive industry. They just don't know it yet. So it's business model innovation, right? We went through process innovation, product innovation, but nobody really knows how to do business model innovation. And we have Jan, who really specializes in that. So Jan, can you introduce yourself and kind of give a little background of how you got here?
Oh, yeah. Hi, everyone. I'm Jan Beranek. I'm the group CEO for Uplus. Uplus is a corporate innovations venture builder that focuses on bringing new business models and basically new digital revenue to existing companies. We typically work with the corporate innovations teams, or sometimes even some companies have their own division set up with their own P&L specifically tailored to creating new digital revenue. COVID accelerated quite a bit, especially with industries such as automotive. So I guess that's how I got here to talk to you guys about that.
Wow. So yeah, let's hear a little bit about, before we get really into the podcast, let's hear a little about what you think about Cruise Automation deploying in San Francisco and what do consumers expect from that?
So why Sunset? I think the answer is because it's easier, right? There's much less going on, you know, perpendicular streets. There could be things like, you know, kids running after a soccer ball or something like that into a street. So it could test some of these edge cases that could potentially be lethal, which would be the worst case scenario for them. But you don't have trams. You don't have people, you know, not obeying laws that much there. You don't have red lights every single time and you don't have, you know, five-way, crossing. So that sort of a thing. But like what happens in a self-driving car? I think it's life, right? So whatever happens in a self-driving car when you're a passenger right now, and is like the most probably naive immediate answer, but maybe what's more interesting to talk about is you already have business goals, right? You have you already do business while you're in an Uber or Lyft or something like that.
That's right. Yeah.
When you're commuting, right? My girlfriend has her company has a shuttle, right, that goes to South San Francisco. So she has like 20 minutes of work there, 20 more minutes of work back, and sort of expected that it happens anyways. She can join calls. Whether or not there's a driver, it doesn't necessarily change the use case or the customer journey for that person there. But probably a more interesting question is like what could happen, right? So what are the other things that could happen? Is the you see all these prototypes with the seats sort of towards each other and not sort of in line. So does that promote more collaboration? And is that like, will you have an executive self-driving car that is laid out this way? Will you rent those as sort of boardrooms when you're trying to get from place to place? I mean, that could be something, but I think the general answer is just life happens, right? And
right.
I think the humanities progress is one of the measures that I remember I read is like the amount of things that you happen automatically for you that consume energy that you don't have to think about, right? So this is one of you moving from a place to place, right?
Interesting.
Yeah.
So what do you think, I mean, how do you get a consumer right now? You're just getting in the car and you're going from point A to point B, but how do you get a consumer to pay more than they would as a regular Lyft? How do you add value on a subscription basis in that autonomous ride?
Well, there's some obvious things around mobility, right? So you get the car faster, you get nicer cars, you get bigger cars, that sort of a thing. That's probably the obvious thing. But the less obvious and more exciting from a business model innovation and probably revenue generation standpoint is, so what are all the other services that you can offer that person while they're going? It can be, you know, anything from massage to, masterclass kind of situation, right? So you get to that boardroom kind of car, and it could be upskilling for your workforce while they're commuting to work. Like it could be things like that. And you offer that platform. It's like Tesla just yesterday or 2 days ago, it's just rumors that they're building their own app store, which is a super obvious thing, right? For something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, Lyft is already, well, Uber as well, it's already offering a kind of subscription layer on top of their service where it's really just discounts for rides, right? You don't get any additional comfort or service or anything, but maybe they're testing out that business model to add these kinds of features like better lighting. Maybe if you're going out on a Friday night and you want to have a more enjoyable car ride to your club or your bar, you pay a premium subscription service that allows you to choose those add-ons that kind of give you the VIP treatment, which is what people want in the consumer vehicle market right now. Like they pay more for a better car that looks nicer.
But let's take the stretch of road, right? Let's take 101 between San Francisco and San Jose, right? If you pick the wrong time, it's going to take you 2 hours to get to San Jose.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. You can, of course, take a train. I actually don't know if Caltrain has first class or anything, like if you can pay more. So, okay, so probably not, right? But what if you could offer something that, you know, you just have to go to an in-person meeting. You just have to be there and travel at the wrong time. So what are the things that I would probably care about? It's like consistent connection. You know, I'm on T-Mobile. Every time I get out of San Francisco, I lose connection for a little bit, right? before I get to SFO. So that's no good. So can I continue with my life with the things I need to do while I'm being in this situation that would not normally be great for me, right? Can I consume or be productive while I'm in there, right? So I guess what are all of those things that you would do if you just took out the travel time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and it's no different than, I guess, being in a living room or being in, depending on what the modality is, but like being in a living room or being at work, right? When you're meeting with other people. So
yeah, it segues nicely into the next discussion of what you offer and how this can kind of change the automotive industry, at least. So from what I read is you offer innovation consulting, execution, scaling, and operations. And that means a lot from business model innovation, because yep. I don't think the automotive industry is ready to do that. So can you explain each of those and what exactly that means?
But it's happening, like if it's ready or not, it's happening anyways, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So what we do is you can call it an innovation ops, innovation operations layer, right? So corporations, you know, innovation is the best way to protect and grow your market share. And in automotive, on many different layers, many different tiers, things are changing quite rapidly, whether or not you're looking at it, what the Chinese OEMs are doing, or whether you're looking at like how Tesla is changing what you're actually paying for in an experience. So, because it's such an important thing, you would think that companies would be great at it. Well, it turns out most of them aren't, because they're set up as having people who are operators, not innovators, mm-hmm. which is great. You know, you have an existing business model that works, it produces money. You have to have that kind of people, right? But those are not typically a kind of people that will create something net new for you and will be able to iterate very quickly. And that in itself holds a mismatch of mindset that you need for that kind of work, and also skill set that you need for that kind of work. So you have a sort of a mismatch in workforce in a way that it doesn't allow you to be really innovative and progress, right? So that's where we come in. One more thing that we also see is a sort of a data-driven framework on how to know how to make these decisions, which things to continue with, which things to kill, when you need to pivot. You know, what is the stage gate process for you to deploy capital in an intelligent way so that you get the most out of these activities? Because not all of them will succeed as you're trying to figure out what makes the most sense, right? So how to pick the best bets. So that's where we come in. And we also see we solve for one more sort of horizontal issue, which is you typically have there's no shortage of slides, of innovation strategy slides that tell you what you should do. There's also no shortage of ideas that could be potentially executed upon, but that typically doesn't happen, right? Because we literally had a customer that said, well, we spent $120 million on building this up and we have 500 customers for it, consumers, right? So not 500,000, 500. So there is something that we call the innovation execution gap, where you have these slides and then you have a mismatched workforce. But then if you sort of got over that hump and found de-risked the process and found some product market fit, then that workforce started being a little bit more relevant, right? So that's what we fill in. And we're there from the very beginning, from the idea down to the revenue. There's a process of how to get there. But one more thing that we've seen, and Europe has been a little bit ahead of it because the startup ecosystem is not that large. So corporations had to, if they wanted to build something new, they sort of had to deploy their own capital or resources or build out these types of teams by themselves sooner. So what we're seeing, what we've been seeing there is if you build it completely outside and then try to hand it over then to an existing business unit that had nothing to do with how that evolved, that's also not super successful. So that's why we're there the whole time from idea to revenue, but also we want at least one person from that company who is there with us, who's the future CEO or business leader, what have you, right? For that endeavor, for that new business model, for that net new potentially company that we're building, right? So that they understand what insights are happening. They can translate inside the organization. We give them all the insights and data, et cetera, right? So that sort of creates a successful way of, or more successful, more likely successful way of executing on innovation and actually moving forward. Thank you.
Wonderful. Yeah, that's really great work that you're doing. And I think you're providing a service that the automotive industry in particular really needs for those reasons that you pointed out. Maybe for our listeners, could you point out a particular example of what you've done for a company? I've read some of your case studies and found a lot of them interesting. You've got a peer-to-peer car sharing case study, one on virtual batteries. Maybe there's one that you really like that you could share with us.
I like the virtual battery one. It has nothing to do with automotive, but it's for an energy provider in Europe where it was, I think, 4 years ago, where we're tasked with figuring out how to build and sort of industry 4.0 backend, so it's IoT connected, cloud, things like that.
Okay.
And figure out how to incentivize people to put solar panels in their house. And one of the things is solar panels produced during the day and produced during the night. Right. So what can you do? You can sort of use the grid as a balancer for that. It has its own intrinsic challenges. The grid has to be ready for it. A part of that project was figuring out which IoT devices to sort of measure the current from solar panels to your meter to your grid. Right. And when you're sort of pumping energy into the grid, you're charging your virtual battery. And then when you're consuming energy from the grid, it sort of discharges your virtual battery. There's no actual battery, but there's just data that we capture, right? And I thought it was right now, this is 4 or 5 years ago in Europe. And right now there's concepts like this quite often, but I felt this is not the most glamorous thing, but it's a net new innovation that drove new customers that also created an industry 4.0 backend on cloud, which is also a new thing, for the company at large. Right. So then new things, new dashboards, new business models could be generated on top of that. That's one. And the other one that's more automotive, Sean Shepard, our managing partner for North America, three exits in Silicon Valley, three VC funds in Silicon Valley as well. So he worked with Bridgestone on their IntelliTire project, which is the intelligent pressure sensors to give you data and about the pressure in the tires. And that sort of spurred a whole business unit that's called Mobility Solutions that's created just for running all of these new digital business ideas. And Sean said a couple times that the CEO of Bridgestone went on stage a couple of years back and said that the data that's coming out of the tire now is more valuable than the tire itself, right? So because it enables a lot more digital businesses than just selling the tire, generates long-term revenue, right?
I mean, could you unpack that a little bit? Because I think I understand what you mean by long-term revenue by getting that data, but what if someone is listening to this, what does that mean?
Right. So predictive maintenance, for example, right? If I have an 18-wheeler and I preemptively know that some of those tires are about to burst and I'm going to be stranded somewhere in the middle, then the whole gig that I'm running is not going to happen, right? And maybe there are some penalties or maybe I'm not going to get paid at all, right? So it is you can think of it as an insurance service for the provider, for the truck driver or for the trucking company, right? So in terms of preventing losses, this example, but also in generating net new revenue, because you more readily know when your trucks are going to be available and you can have predictive servicing so that they're always at the best shape. And if you have like a slow leak as well in one of the tires or multiple of the tires and your MPG is going to go down, right, then you can save money by not having that, right, and consume less fuel. So that's an example.
You know, I had to take my car 4 times to the dealer to have my tire sensors replaced because I had to have them replaced one at a time because the insurance only covers it after they fail. They won't replace them before they fail. Mm. And we know they're going to fail, but something like that would have really saved everybody money. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you can do it at scale, then you have a real impact on the whole fleet of trucks, right? That have Bridgestone tires. So it's a net positive.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about how consumer habits have changed in purchasing vehicles since the pandemic began, coming out of it, what businesses have flourished, such as Carvana, how OEMs are trying to start their own version of Carvana. Are dealerships in threat, are threatened by this? And where does your company see this business model innovation kind of disrupting everything that we've been doing for the last 100 years? Are we going to see a dynamic shift from that, or are we still on basically the same path?
So in 2017, we started working with a European car one of the European car manufacturers, and they told us then that there are three threats to their revenue in about 10 years. One of them was car sharing, right? So fewer cars get sold. The other one was electric cars. They require less maintenance. So, and that's a big profit and revenue driver, right? So that's that. And then ultimately self-driving, right? So I think there's a stat, something like if you replace all cars in Manhattan with self-driving cars, you would have a tenth of the cars. And on average, and you had like an Uber-like system to hail them. It would take you on average like 36 seconds or something to get a car like that. Right. So imagine what that would do to the city as well. So I think we're on that trajectory, but I think as you see with Tesla Autopilot or rather the FSD, program that they have, like everybody thought it would be much sooner. I think they're at the pace where they're discovering how hard it is. Their pace is much faster than everybody else's. But it's a sort of a moving target, and they're getting, I hope that they're getting closer, right? So that last sort of threat is not going away. There is a good podcast, just on Tuesday, I think last Tuesday on Decoder, there was automotive CEOs and Pete Buttigieg talking about, you know, the future of automotive with the electric cars. What was great to hear from Herbert Diess, the CEO of Volkswagen, he said, well, you know, we're going to keep producing ICE cars, internal combustion engine cars, as well as EVs for some time, because it doesn't, like an EV in a country that doesn't have renewables is worse for the environment than an efficient ICE car, right? So I think his example was Poland that has 100% coal-powered grid. Right. So EVs there are not the best idea ever, mm-hmm. but EVs in Brazil that has 100% hydro are an amazing idea. Right. Mm-hmm. So that's that threat. And then the car sharing piece, I think you see it in cities more and more, right? We moved back to San Francisco and we deliberately said, we don't want to have a car and let's see how it goes. I have the electric skateboard. We're probably going to get electric, bikes, selling my car in Europe as well. So. It's also the kind of life that you want to have, but then this is in cities, in outside of the cities, you of course need the cars to move around, especially in the U.S. that doesn't have an amazing public transportation system as well. So I think we're going to see probably fewer cars being sold at some point. It's going to go down, more car sharing, and the self-driving is sort of, you know, a joker card sometime in the future that's just going to enable more of that. In terms of Carvana, it's more that this just the shortage of new cars, right? The cars are coming, to end of life, and you need new cars, and you're trying to find new ways of. It's the same to me. It's the same thing as Uber and Airbnb. Why the hell, around 2008? Why the hell would you allow somebody to go into your house and sleep there if you didn't need the money, right?
Right.
So I think it's the same thing, and people would not trust it before because it's online and how do I know and things like that. Now they had to, and the experience is actually quite positive, right? So it's just a natural digitization of that environment.
Thank you. Yeah.
Interesting. How much of a role do you think subscription services are going to play in how the consumer interacts with purchases? Both cars, parts, maintenance, and the experience in the vehicle.
I guess it depends on what you're selling, right? Or what you think you're selling, right? Because are you selling tech that constantly evolves and that requires cost to, you know, there are ongoing costs for it to improve, or are you just selling something that it's one and done? And I think more and more you see that it's the former, right? That's the customer expectation. So if that's the customer expectation, the revenue has to be generated somewhere, right? So pretty much everything turns into subscription. And when you think about it, something that almost everybody uses is Microsoft Office has been a license forever. Now it's a subscription, mm-hmm. right? So it's, if you expect continuous iteration of these things, then the money has to come from somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm expecting a pretty big shift in the dollars coming from recurring revenue, from the one and done. Rivian had an article a little while ago about how they expect after the sale of their vehicle, over $15,000 over the life of the vehicle to be in subscription services, like the radio and communication services, GPS, right? So they're expecting consumers to be paying for services after the sale of the vehicle.
Well, back then you could just make the argument that somebody has to provide the internet for the car, right? If you want to stream things like Spotify or Apple Music or things like that, right? So you have to pay for the connectivity. With that amount to $15,000, probably not, right? So there have to be other things. But now, with the rumors of the Tesla App Store, you can imagine that if there's an Apple style cut from what's being sold in there, you're essentially running an affiliate style marketplace, right? For these things. You're providing, I don't know how much they're going to go into providing, you know, security and privacy and things like that. Apple touts that that's one of the reasons why they are the gatekeeper. But you can imagine that there's a net new revenue for them doing this.
Interesting. So just like the smartphone, now your car, you're buying a platform.
And then more and more cars are more like smartphones. Yeah.
Let's unpack that. So let's talk about the world's first trillion-dollar automotive company. What do you think? Are they worth $1 trillion? I got an article from you about standardizing part numbers and standardizing the design of headlights. Is that a good move? Is that a bad move? What's your opinion of all this?
Well, first, there's no trillion-dollar automotive company because Tesla's not an automotive company.
There you go. That's what I wanted to hear.
that's one thing. So they always, you know, and the news is always compared to, you know, Tesla's worth 10 times, you know, more than the 10 next brands, whatever. The, you know, you have to think of Tesla as it's the car company. It's the battery company. It is the Shell as well, or Exxon, right? So they own the gas stations as well. They own the gas, kind of, right? And then they own the production of solar panels for your house and things like that. So they own the whole, they vertically integrated. And therein, I think, lies the multiple that goes into the $1 trillion. Not necessarily just the fact that they have, I think, 2 million cars on the road right now, right? But it's 2 million cars that are platforms for generating future revenue. Like we said with Rivian right now, they own the charging infrastructure that they now can, you know, in, I think in the Netherlands and France, now you can use the superchargers if you're a non-Tesla car as well. So there's many more to them than an automotive piece. But I kind of forgot your question.
No, I just got hung up on the automotive company. I want you to, do you think it's possible for other OEMs to catch up to what Tesla's doing? Can they become non-automotive companies?
I would encourage people, it's a hard question to unpack. I would encourage people to listen to that Decoder podcast from like 2 weeks ago. Because then you have seven CEOs answering this question, and you have, and it's like a gamut of, you know, from one side to the other. Like the Polestar CEO is trying to dance around the fact that Google powers their, you know, car, right? Android Auto. It's probably called something else, but it's the Android Auto stack that lives in the car, right? Mm-hmm. And he's talking about how it's a Polestar experience, but, you know, it's a great relationship and blah, 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 blah. But for example, for me, this sort of a question, and I think that's an interesting consumer perspective, is like, I don't want to buy a car that has Google Anywhere in it because I'm very conscious about where my data goes.
Yeah.
Like data privacy is super important for me. And when I see Google, I know that that's not going to happen. Right.
Well, this happened Wall Street Journal.
It just happened
remember?
To me. Yeah. What did? Sorry.
The New York Times and the Wall Street Journal let Google in to get all their ads and kind of monetize those ads. And then Google started controlling who gets to see what in terms of, do you want articles from Wall Street Journal or New York Times based on revenue?
Oh, yeah. I'm not surprised. I haven't heard, but I'm not surprised.
Yeah. Yeah.
What they just did to me is 2 weeks ago, they said I was in the Czech Republic and they told me, well, we looked at your account and we think that your account should be under the U.S. law. So now you're in the United States. And I'm like, no. And they're like, we checked again and it's United States. And then I had to click. I use VPN a lot of times, blah, blah, blah. And now it's back to the Czech Republic. But the reason I was freaked out about that is I have GDPR and other protections. I have right to be forgotten if I'm like within EU. I don't have that if I'm in the US, right? So it's they essentially downgraded my account without asking me. So that's the sort of a thing that I don't want to happen in my car.
Wow. Wow. Interesting.
Yeah, that's a great point, Alan. That's going to be more relevant as cars start becoming, you know, rolling smartphones that are platforms for all these apps and services. And I think that's really the service that you provide to automotive companies, isn't it? Yeah, and you kind of help them get up to speed with becoming non-automotive companies like Tesla, I think.
Yeah, so the question is if that's what needs to happen, right? What we're looking at is you have some of the existing assets. And what is the best way to create net new digital revenue from it? Or figure out that, you know, there isn't, which rarely is the case. Mm-hmm. So what are the trends of where you need to go? Right. So, I don't necessarily think that everybody has to look like Tesla. There's plenty of space. They're still selling, you know, a million cars a year. And people are buying way, way more. Right. But what's interesting about them is you can look at them again as sort of Apple, where they have vertical integration. They own the ecosystem from the ground up. And it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out with the current government, where they, you know, for the first time, they said the word Tesla, which
That's
is
right.
a whole controversy, right? Because they don't like the way they're organized, you know, things like that. But it's also around the world, what will other governments say? But there's, you know, when you look at how Volkswagen's big, how GM, Ford, you know, there's plenty of momentum they have. And I think they should cherry pick the stuff that's relevant for them to focus on. Mm. Right. I think GM or Ford that's launching the Carvana competitor, right? Car Bravo.
Yeah.
Right. So those are the sort of things that, maybe Carvana is going to be the Groupon, let's say, right? But there's no reason for why not to replace your existing, for example, dealership model with this, right? And you own it completely. You don't have to give cuts to dealers. But then it's again, like then a lot of people are out of jobs. So that's an endless discussion and how that, you know, what that does to your brand. But from a customer point of view, right, there's this right now, I think Ford said that they're going to stop selling the new Lightning, F-150 Lightning, to dealers that have insane markups.
Yep. Right? Yep.
If you own that experience, then that doesn't happen, then you don't have scalpers.
Yeah.
Right. So
that's right.
And if like with graphics cards or something like that, or anything that has computer chips in them, When the stock is limited, these things are going to happen, and there's some people who are going to pay for that. But are those the people that you want to have the car? Is that on brand? Is that the experience that you want to have? Probably not, right? So those are some real, regardless of Tesla, there's market demand for change.
Great. Well, I really appreciate having you here today. Before you go, could you offer some advice for some new grads that are trying to get into the industry you have, or any professionals that want to work in something that you do?
Interesting. I'll try. For automotive or for innovation?
Innovation. Digitizing innovation.
Yeah, for innovation, I think it's the ability to fall on your face many, many times and be okay with that. and learn from it and do it in a systematic way. And I think that's innovation in a nutshell. But that's sort of what we're looking for in the people that we hire. We see that those are good proxy is or are musicians or sports people who you suck until you get good, right? And that takes time and effort. And that process is not easy. And nothing in life is really free. And if you're building these new things, that's just how it's going to work. It's not going to work until, you know, one day you crack a little bit of it and then you need to iterate on it. And it's a very iterative process. And that you have to be ready for that. So you have to be driven. You have to persevere in doing so. And you have to be willing to also talk to a lot of people. Because what we say, a part of our pitch is we ask people to give us two things, their time and truth. If they give us their time and tell us what they really want, then we can build interesting things from that. But then you need to iterate on it. And then what we found also is people, I don't know how that translates to the US. In Europe, we find that people who move between countries are also a good proxy because could be between states here, but the culture is kind of similar. What that does is there are different ways to express ideas and have a constructive discussion. And you have to learn to have that while discussing tough things like, you know, what we just built doesn't work, right? And why doesn't it work? And what's the data, right? And you have to be non-abrasive in these sort of discussion. And that leads to constructive, creative, net new things that can happen very, very quickly, right? So that's part sort of that mindset. Mindset that you have to have when you're trying to build something like that. So in terms of, for example, books, for me, it's like Extreme Ownership is a great book for that that I would recommend. Mm-hmm. Things like, you know, 0 to 1, Atomic Habits, those typical books that I think are really good. But if you saw yourself in a bit of what I was describing, then you're on a good path to do something like that. And you can engineer your luck to find the path.
Fantastic. I think it's very interesting that all the things you mentioned in what you look for in a new hire or candidate are all things like, you know, sports player, musician, somebody who's tried something difficult, knows how to fail, communicating, cross-cultural understanding. You didn't really mention so much the knowledge and the technical skills, which I'm sure is also important. But you shared what
those you can teach. Really. Mm-hmm. Those you can teach.
You can learn those, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lot of those things that I mentioned. Those are very hard to teach, right? Mm-hmm. Those are, you have to live through them, and that take time. They take time, right? Mm-hmm. You know, somebody can learn to code, but if they give up, you know, after an hour when something doesn't work, then you know it's not going to happen.
Great. Yeah.
Okay. Well, great. Thank you very much for being on this episode of Mobility Now. Really appreciate it. And this time we won't lose it. I'm going to make sure I record and save it because this was awesome. And this was a lot of knowledge unpacked. So thanks again, and hope to get together with you soon in San Francisco.
Thank you, guys. Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it.